face last week, but I reread all of it again this week, and it stuck out to me largely. And the servants of the king of Syria said to him, "Their gods are gods of the hills, and so they were stronger than we, but let us fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they. And do this, remove the kings, each from his post, and put commanders in their places, and muster an army like the army that you have lost, horse for horse, and chariot for chariot. Then we'll fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they." And he listened to their voice and did so. In the spring, Ben-Hadad mustered the Syrians and went up to Aphek to fight against Israel. And the people of Israel were mustered and were provisioned and went against them. The people of Israel encamped before them like two little flocks of goats. But the Syrians filled the country, and a man of God came near and said to the king of Israel, "Thus says the Lord, because the Syrians have said, 'The Lord is a God of the hills, but he is not a God of the valleys,' therefore I will give all this great multitude into your hand, and you shall know that I am the Lord." And they encamped opposite one another 7 days. Then on the seventh day, the battle was joined, and the people of Israel struck down of the Syrians 100,000 foot soldiers in one day. And the rest fled into the city of Aphek, and the wall fell upon 27,000 men who were left. Ben-Hadad also fled and entered an inner chamber in the city. And his servants said to him, "Behold, now we have heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. Let us put on sackcloth around our waist and ropes on our heads and go out to the king of Israel. Perhaps he will spare your life." It goes on, but the part that's repetitive, and anytime there's repetition in the Bible, it's something to focus on or look at. The thing that I'm surprised I didn't pick up on last time, and is now one of my favorite stories, is the Syrians, what was their advice to the king? Muster up an army, the same as you had. Their gods are the gods of the valleys. Let's fight them on the plain. And then Ben-Hadad, which isn't in the best standing with God right now, or not Ben-Hadad, the king of Israel, who's not in the best standing, wife's Jezebel, doing all this not so great stuff. God comes to him and says, "Hey, because they think that I'm not the God of everything, I'm going to use you." And it describes their army. Two little flocks of goats. "I'm going to use you to wipe out the Syrian army." And one day they killed 100,000 foot soldiers. I don't know why that resonated so much with me this week. But how oftentimes do we take God out of certain aspects of our life? How often do we give him this little piece of what we're doing and don't give him the whole thing? How often do we entrust him to the plains or to the valleys but not entrust him to the plains? How often do we make these separations in our life? And it's such a neat story because these people who their whole mindset is there's gods for everything, right? Their whole culture, they have tons of gods. They worship a god for the sun, a god for the moon, a god for, the water, a god for fertility, a god for egg. You just go down the list. They have all these gods. And so in their heads, oh, they must worship the gods of the valley. God comes back and says, "I'm going to do this so that you'll know that I'm Lord." Not Lord of the plains as well, and he's just got divine authority talked about it last week, and I think these stories are so well put into place, is that when God is trying to compel or fire up Elijah to go back and talk to the king, and he's scared because Jezebel's, got a hit out for him. And he makes the earth shake before him. It brings huge wind. Then he makes the earth shake, a huge earthquake, and then he brings fire. And then right afterwards, he just whispers to him. He just talks to him. And then that same God, on the outside looking in, they're trying to put him in this little box of a God of the valley. And he comes and squashes that. With an army that's depicted as two little flocks of goats, and the Syrians filled the valley. This is the same language that we're talking about when God makes a promise to Abraham and is talking about him filling the earth and there being more descendants than sands on the seashore. So they're depicting this massive army from the Syrians. And this is the second time that king has raised this equivalent army. And God's crushed it twice. That's pretty neat to think about. And I think very intentionally this story was put in for our understanding that God doesn't fit in the boxes that we like to put him in. Because we like to put him in boxes a lot of times. We like to try to make this thing make sense or what. And out of doing that, we like to put him in this box and say, hey, God, I'm going to put you in this little box, and what I need right now is healing. So now you're the healing God. It's one of my favorite things that I taught Brooks ish. Anytime he gets a hurt or an owie, we tell him, hey, Jesus will heal it. So he's got cuts on his hand. It made his mom a little sad. But anytime she says, do you want me to kiss it better? He says, no, Jesus got it. Jesus will make me feel better. She says, it makes me sad, but it makes me happy. But in his head, that's Jesus' box right. Jesus makes him better. When he's sick, Jesus will heal him. When he's hurt, Jesus is going to heal him. That's the perspective of a two-year-old. This is the box that he's got God in. But we take that such an innocent box that's placed on God from the mind of a child. And then we say, oh, he's just two, right? How often do we do that? As adults, as 20, 30, 40, 60, 70, 80-year-olds, right? We find this need, this itch that needs to be scratched, and we take God and we put it in this. And then we have something that we're going through, that we're struggling with, or whatever the case may be, and we hide that part away. And I think oftentimes there's just this guilt or this shame that we don't want to take it to God when God already knows what's going on. And biblically speaking, I mean, we talked about Matthew, I think it's chapter 11, verse 23, when it says, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. And he's asking for it all. Not just these little aspects of our life, but he's asking for the totality of it. When it seems like we don't want to burden God with whatever we're going through, or maybe we think it's too minuscule. And he's just saying, hey, I want to be a part of it all. Just let me in. Don't push me out from this side of your life. Just let me have it. The good, the bad, the ugly. And we do it with the good, the bad, and the ugly. We saw in Solomon that when the things are going good, what happens? Right? He starts to pull away a little bit. Sometimes with the bad, we just don't want to talk about it. We just want to turn face and hide. Because we know what we're doing is wrong, and we don't want to talk to God about it because we're scared. He said, this is what I sent my son down for. Let's give it up. The ugly that nobody needs to know, that we don't want anybody to know. Probably if you have a relationship with God, the most ashamed you are of it. And it's not that God doesn't see it. It's that we're not willing to hand it over. He's a big God. He can handle it way better than we can handle it on ourselves. So that is, I guess I already burned a little bit of time. There's no way I'm going to get it. I do this every week. I'm going to open it up. Comments, questions on that. Ideas, thoughts. We'll go to Elisha. In your books, it's 94. We did read about it last week. God calls Elisha through Elijah. Dad's talked quite a bit about it. We've started. Has anybody watched The Chosen? I know Kevin's talked about it quite a bit. Jaden and I started actually watching it instead of just every once in a while. And I don't know, I'm a visual, I like visual learning. Reading's not always my favorite. we're gonna, this is a deep, I've thought about a lot how God's called, Christ has called his disciples, Jesus calls his disciples. After watching that, in this calling of Elisha, y'all are going to have to forgive me if I cross those two up, maybe several times. Elisha, they sound the same, so I will try to enunciate very clearly. So, 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 19, the call of Elisha. So he departed from there and found Elisha. This is after God has put on display his power, his authority to Elijah. And God calls Elijah to go appoint kings over nations and also appoint his successor. His successor is going to be Elisha. So he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen in front of him, and he was with the 12. Elijah passed by him and cast his cloak upon him, and he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, "Let me kiss my father and mother, and then I will follow you." And he said to him, "Go back again. For what have I done to you?" And he returned from following him and took the yoke of oxen and sacrificed them and boiled their flesh with the yokes of oxen and gave it to the people and they ate. And he arose and went after Elijah and assisted him. That's the short calling of Elisha. And we get into Elisha more. I think at least next week's also going to be about Elisha. But how many of y'all for anything would just get up and leave? I mean, what reels in my mind is, and if you watch The Chosen, there's some interesting, and I'm not saying The Chosen is the most biblically accurate. I mean, they fill in a lot of blanks. So I don't want to, I'm not saying, but it makes your mind think. I think it's a fairly accurate depiction of the times. I think they stay on course with the Bible, about the stories of the Bible. Who's ever done that? Who's ever filled in the blanks in your head as you read through the Bible? Like, we get these snippets, but you know how much time elapses between each story? I mean, this wasn't, David's day wasn't just the stories we read. I mean, when David's ruling over his people, there's just the menial day-to-day that we don't necessarily read. And when Jesus is calling his disciples, it blows me away. And there's one depiction of Simon. And they depict, is Simon married? Actually, in the Bible?
Peter,
okay. So they depict this interaction with Christ. And Christ calls Simon to follow him. And then the next scene that you have is Simon Peter talking to his wife. And his wife just starts weeping. And he's like, I have to do this. And she's like, I'm not crying because you're leaving. I'm crying because someone finally saw in you what I see in you. And there's just this incredible interaction between man and wife, and a guy who's about to uproot and leave everything for what he can't even get close to imagining. Right? What the journey that he's about to take is going to be nothing like what he's expecting. In the show, he's the guy who's always talking about the rebellion, like uprooting the Roman Empire. He's the guy you can kind of see where the show gets that, because biblically, he's the fire guy, right? He brings the excitement, the energy, the fire, and you can just see that he's probably just high strung, ready to roll all the time. And so this is the depiction of that guy. And then he's talking to his wife, and he's like, no, I have to do this. For some reason, that he's in the movie, in the show, it says, it's just the way he looked at me. Like, there's something just different. Because you don't just uproot everything and leave for nothing, right? There's got to be something different. So I imagine this quote gets thrown over Elisha, and he's working the oxen. And I imagine just in this moment, there's just something different. And Elijah is not someone who's been in the shadows. He's not, his name is probably out there, right? In the same way that people were expecting a Messiah, though they missed it, but Elijah's name's out there. So you get your cloak thrown on by, at the time, kind of the guy. This, by that I mean, this is also, we talked a little bit about it last week. He's appointing the next Syrian king. As an Israelite. The kings of foreign countries regard this man enough that they kind of look to him. He's in their courtrooms. That's the guy that throws his cloak around you. And what's the immediate reaction of Elisha? Let me go tell everything that I've known, everybody that I've known, this little village that I grew up in. Let me go say my goodbyes and then I'll follow you. I wish that was our reaction sometimes. I wish that that's how, and I get that sometimes with everything that's going on around us, and that there's not necessarily, like right now, that there's this physical guy that we can take up and we can go follow. But we have the same calling. And what you see in this story of Elisha, and what you see in the calling of the disciples, is when that calling is made, what do? Give up everything. And I don't want, and there's, I've talked about prosperity gospel. I'm going to flip it. I also don't want this to turn into poverty gospel. Because there's both sides, right? Is where I should just give everything I have and just go live homeless and then rely on... No, I'm not. I don't want us to get crossways. I'm saying what God has given you in whatever capacity that you have it, every decision I was listening to podcasts this morning. What we do in our walks with life should be geared towards God. The interactions that you have on a day-to-day basis should be glorifying to God. That's what giving it all up means. It means God may give you something. Use it for His glory. This isn't, I don't want to get, again, I don't really, really, really don't want to get in the weeds and get it all twisted. This isn't a tithing sermon. This isn't anything like that. It's that to give everything you have to Him doesn't mean writing big checks to the church. To give everything you have and to follow Him means everything that God has put in your capacity, your home, your whatever, should be used to glorify Him. That's what we're called to. I was listening to the Bible Project this morning, just a little thing they had about the prophets. And I really appreciated what they were saying, is because what the prophets are doing is they're communicating. They're the physical communicator. God's talking to them. They're relaying messages. Sometimes prophecy and how we see it typically, and like a futuristic type thing, and the rising and falling of kingdoms and all this stuff. Sometimes it's just like this day-to-day type thing. And what they talk about, what I appreciated, is when they go and they're talking to Jesus and they're really trying to kind of pinpoint, kind of trap him, right? What's the greatest command? What is this? And there's like 632 commands in the Torah. And what are they hoping to do? Let's just make this guy say something crazy so where we can be like, it's just, I love to argue. Sorry, babe. Sorry, mom and dad. Sorry, everybody. I like to argue. So in that position, my mind works with the Pharisees. It's terrible, but it does. is if I'm trying to pin something on somebody, I ask this super vague question. And then, though it doesn't mean it at all, what's my immediate response? If he says, don't commit murder, right? I'm thinking, well, does that mean that adultery's not bad? Does that mean, like, that's a guarantee where they're going next. Does that mean all these other 631 commandments in the Torah mean nothing? That this one's so important? And Christ's response to that is, the greatest commands, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor. And they're kind of like, oh, I don't really remember reading that, right? But that should be, and I love what they said, because we talk about, in the Sermon on the Mount, we talked a little bit about the wisdom. Christ is giving us just this glimpse of wisdom behind the logs. Do y'all remember I preached a couple sections on it? Kevin preached several sections on it. Is that God's giving us these little glimpses into the wisdom behind do not lust. Do not murder. And he's showing the heart in which this should take place. And Christ encompasses all that with two things. Love God, love your neighbor. Right? Let's just dumb it down. Let's just say that. That pretty much encompasses everything. And so you start to read these laws and you're like, well, how does that fit in? And then you start to see how everything, all these 632 laws really fit in about loving God and loving your neighbor. If our day-to-day is focused on that, and what they say is, I think, profound, even though it's just the most simple statement, is a lot of times people will argue on the minute details of this, on the laws. They like to play the Pharisee, right? They like to get legalistic with everything. And God takes it from this legalistic, where everybody wants to argue. Christ takes it from this legalistic, everybody wants to argue, into something profound that went over a lot of people's heads, which seems silly because it's one line, right? What he said is we like to argue about these legalist ideas. But if your intent and your focus is living out those two commands, which is said one, but those really two commands, how far off can you really get? Probably not very. If my intent is to treat my neighbor how Christ would treat him, is to love him, is to be right by him, and I take a step and it may be wrong, but how far off can I really get? Is that our compass? Day to day, is that our compass? In an altercation with somebody or in a conversation with somebody, is that what's guiding it? Because the wisdom behind all of it, he reveals in that little tiny line, is if you're treating people like that, you're actively pursuing God like that. It's not saying you're going to be perfect, but that's saying, how many of y'all have had an interaction with somebody where your main focus was to be a reflection of God, and it just went abysmally wrong? Not that somebody didn't draw away, because that's going to happen. But how many times have you walked away from that conversation with those things in mind, that you walk away and say, man, I did not reflect Christ well? Probably not. If that's your intent, if that's your focus, if that's what you're pointing your true north off of, and let me say this also, if you don't know what God's saying, if you don't know what's going on in the story of the Bible, you're not going to be able to treat people that way. So it's incredibly important. Because without it, your true north, you can just, it's kind of guess, right? Guesswork. I don't think God intended a lot of this to be guesswork. I think when Christ was saying that, I think that was pretty clear for a lot of people. I think the Pharisees in their mindset, because I do this all the time, the Pharisees in their mindset looking for something to argue probably missed it. Right? Because anytime you're just in the arguing mood and you're trying to stick somebody on something and they make a fantastic point that should probably just squash it right there, you probably miss it because that's not where your head's geared towards. But when you're having an interaction with somebody and you're working on acting out of love, reflecting Christ's love, loving God and loving your neighbor, whew, sounds a whole lot easier. Doesn't that sound way easier than keeping 632 commands in the Torah? Where you start to see this push is in the New Testament when God tells his disciples, or his disciples are to go out and gather this, start talking to Gentiles, not just keep it amongst Jews. We see a lot of even arguments in the Bible is letters that are written to churches where this has become an issue. Where the Gentiles not keeping the laws of the Torah is becoming this huge dividing wall between people and churches. And those letters are typically written in a harsh tone, where it's angry. To Paul, writing a letter to a church, it's frustrating to watch them divide themselves over what God didn't come to abolish but fulfill, and out of that should have brought unity. And it takes the reminder, he's going to get me again. It takes the reminder of why are we arguing over all this? Why aren't we just living for the sole fact that, hey, you should be loving God and loving the people around you? Because that's the best reflection of Christ. I love, again, visuals. So when I love the chosen, where you just, man, there's one scene where he heals the leper. And Simon draws his sword. Simon's ready to strike this guy down because he's getting close to the Messiah. Again, I'm not saying this is... they fill in. This is a dramatized version, right? But you can see when they've left everything to be with this guy, there's a fight or flight response, right? And so Simon's the fight guy all the time. He wants to fight. So he draws his sword out. He's ready to strike this leper down. Why? Because he's just left everything he knows to be with this guy, Jesus, who's walking. How serious are people going to take him if he's walking around with leprosy? None. So you can see the thought process of why that's depicted the way it is and what shocks everybody. Is when Christ doesn't just speak healing in. He walks up to him and he touches him. This is like earth-shattering stuff. Christ is just doing is he's Matthew is another funny depiction in The Chosen. He's kind of like this really precise. He's a tax collector, so he's got things. He's got wealth. He's got money. People are appalled when he leaves what he has to go follow Christ and just be this sojourner, right? And people just spit at him all the time because why? He chose the way of the Roman life. He wasn't born into it. He chose to be a tax collector. So everybody around him is hating him. That's something that we don't often depict well in our minds. And what happens? Jesus calls him? Probably not to the liking of the other disciples that are already following him, right? They've been spitting on this guy for years. And now you're going to ask him to follow us? Follow you with us? His movements, his actions, are this giant display of love. Loving God, loving the people around you. It sounds so basic, but how often we forget to do that. I hope that our reactions from here forward are that of Elisha, are that of the disciples, where we understand this calling that we're supposed to be walking into, supposed to be full force into. But I also hope we realize how that's supposed to be done. We're called to be reflections of Christ. Figure out what that looks like. And live it, not with partiality, not just letting God be the God of finances, not just letting God be the God of whatever, fill it in. Just give it all up. Let God be your God of everything. Let him take over. Let go of the reins. Your decisions, your steps should be framed out of that of, is this honoring to God? Is this loving God? And is this loving the people around him? And I would challenge us, I wish I had another couple hours, but the world's depiction of love is so contorted. Don't fall for that. This lovey-dovey, this gut feeling, this all the junk that gets pitched of love, it's not there. Read the Bible. Read the Old Testament where a lot of stuff doesn't look like love. Read it front to back. Figure it out. This whole story is a story of love. How can you say that? Because in the beginning, God made it where we had a relationship with him. His goal at the end is to bring it back to relationship with him. It's not done out of hatred or annoyance. All that's done out of love. Figure out what love looks like. Maybe we'll talk about it more. But figure out what love looks like. It's not this muddy garbage that the world presents. And lust or whatever else, and just acceptance. It's this strong, overwhelming feeling that causes people to leave everything they do and follow God. And it's this strong, overwhelming presence that made everybody who thought that they knew what was going on hate Christ. Because of what he was doing. That's not just this hodgepodge, accept everybody. And I'm not saying don't love everybody. I'm just saying that this acceptance lingo that gets pitched around now is is, is not love. If you love somebody, where do you want them to spend eternity? Heaven. Does that mean you should be accepting of all their decisions? Does that mean God loves sin and accepts it? No. It means God loved us, sent his only son down to die for us so that we could have a relationship with him. But the only reason he had to do that is because of sin. So don't justify it. Alright, Howard over. Caleb's probably laughing at me back there. Thank y'all for being here. It's good to see y'all. We'll be back at it next week.